You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferrer.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, being able to work from home has been seen as a perk that many companies offer to attract top talent. But working remotely may be getting phased out. We'll learn why in a bit.
First, a March for Science is planned for this Saturday in Washington, D.C. and cities around the world. Thousands are expected to demonstrate in support of scientific work that's well-funded, clearly communicated, and that informs public policy.
Politicians often cite science to back up their positions, but our next guest says that more often than not, they get it wrong. With crucial issues like climate change and vaccination being debated in Congress, he believes there's too much at stake to let that continue.
Dave Levitan is with us now. He's a journalist focusing on science, health, and the environment. He's the author of the book, Not a Scientist, How Politicians Mistake, Misrepresent, and Utterly Mangle Science. Dave, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, the title of your book comes from what you see as a habit among a lot of politicians, where they sort of preface a statement about science by saying, oh, I'm not a scientist. Can you talk about this apparently humble statement that you say is actually kind of problematic?
Sure. So to me, it's kind of a bit of a dodge. They use this statement, I'm not a scientist, to basically set off science as somehow unknowable, to make it seem like something that no one really knows anything about, and yet they'll go right ahead and talk about it or you know, legislate about it or do any number of things about it. It serves to sort of make science sound like a thing no one knows, rather than a thing that many people know about. So I think they use it in a very sort of deceptive way.
Well, politicians will have to deal with science issues, and most of them are not scientists. We'll spend a lot of time talking about the subject of your book, how it goes wrong. But how would you like to see someone, say, in Congress or in the White House, for that matter, approach issues where there's a huge science component?
Well, I mean, I think the most fundamental message is to listen to experts, to listen to expertise. I mean, that sounds sort of silly and basic, but they do that for, I mean, politicians do that for any number of other issues. They'll listen to economics experts or, you know, experts on some part of the world that there's a crisis in. But they just need to listen to scientists. And often we do know quite a lot about, you know, whatever issue it is that they're dealing with, if they pick the right people. So it really is a matter of sort of surrounding yourself with the right people and making sure that you're letting the science have an input rather than just let the politics or sort of the other inputs dictate how you approach those issues.
Why do you think science is so politicized now? I mean, it's got obviously a lot of partisan components to it in our public conversations now. Why is that?
You know, that's a good question. I mean, it's not like it's a new issue. I mean, there always have been, you know, political inputs into how we treat science. Clearly, it seems to have gotten to another level in the last, you know, few years or even a decade or two. I don't have a great answer for exactly why. I mean, people have written other books all about that. Clearly, there's a lot to do with money in politics and the influence of industry and, I mean, you know, climate change is sort of the obvious one there, and the influence of fossil fuel companies. It's hard to say exactly why that it has gotten so politicized today. I think there's a lot to do with, you know, sort of how politicians approach the issues, even after the sort of the money is gone. I mean, there are examples now of politicians being even more sort of anti-science than those interests that maybe started that. So It seems to have sort of spiraled out of control in a way, but I don't think there's one great answer for why that has happened.
Well, I want to get into the bulk of your book, which is looking at different sort of errors in the way politicians talk about science, whether it's intentional or not. One of the most common you say is oversimplification. What's happening there?
So, yeah, that's sort of the most straightforward of the errors I talk about. It's just the idea that a politician will take a very complicated scientific issue and just sort of boil it down to a soundbite. And, of course, that can be useful sometimes. It's not necessarily a bad thing to try and explain something that is complicated in simple terms. It's just that if you do that and get it wrong, and you're taking a complicated issue and saying very quickly wrong thing about it, then suddenly everyone will be very confused, because you're not taking the time to explain any of the nuance or any of the complexity that is involved in many scientific issues. So that happens quite a lot. And again, it can be useful, but only if it's done well.
And another, you say kind of the most extreme type of error is completely made up stuff. And how often do we see that coming out of politicians?
Yeah, no, that happens more than we would hope, I guess. Those are interesting because sometimes they can be just so egregious that it's pretty obvious. It's actually not that hard for people to see through, even if you don't happen to be an expert on the topic. But sometimes it can be a little more damaging because they'll say something and there doesn't seem to be any evidence or any particular support for it, but it might sound reasonable just on its face. So sometimes they can be pretty tough to see through. But I do think that generally, though they are insidious, it actually isn't that tough for the media or just for people in people who hear this the particular talking point to see through it.
An example you come back to in a couple different chapters, actually, is the idea that a single volcano puts out more, it's a couple different places, either climate change pollutants or acid rain pollutants than all of human activity for X number of years. This is something that's recurred over time.
It actually was the first example that I found, at least, of anybody using the I'm not a scientist line was Ronald Reagan in 1980. He was talking about emissions of sulfur dioxide from Mount St. Helens, which had erupted recently. He was very, very wrong. Humans were responsible for a lot more sulfur dioxide emissions. And then decades later, Mike Huckabee liked to talk about how volcanoes were responsible for more CO2 emissions than humans, and he was wrong by just an incredible amount. I mean, just orders of magnitude of wrong. It was pretty amazing, actually.
Talking to Dave Levitan, his new book is Not a Scientist, How Politicians Mistake, Misrepresent, and Utterly Mangle Science. I want to get to one more example, and this one gets a little complicated in some cases. You call it the certain uncertainty, and I guess that's where we say, well, if the scientists aren't 100% sure, we need to go back and look for more information. How does this work?
Yeah, so this is one that comes up maybe more commonly than anything, maybe other than that oversimplification. The idea being that because there is some uncertainty in a scientific field or in a given measurement, that we shouldn't do anything about it. I mean, the argument is basically we don't know everything, so we should do nothing. Obviously, climate change is sort of the big one here. People like to talk about how there's still uncertainty in the measurements of temperature rise and the measurements of projected sea level rise. And because we lack every last bit of information, that means we don't know anything. And it's a pretty ridiculous argument because every single measurement ever taken, every single scientific theory and everything you can think of has some degree of uncertainty. That doesn't mean we don't know anything about it. It means we still know a ton about climate change and about all sorts of other issues. But they use this all the time as a way to just sort of delay, to stop us from doing something where just because we don't know every last thing, because we're not 100% certain, then we can't do anything about it.
Those are just a few of the examples of the kinds of statements politicians make. But, you know, on the eve of this March for Science coming up, what can the scientific community, what can people in the science world do to help bridge the gap between public understanding, these obfuscations, and what actually happens in the world of science?
That's a great question. Again, I'm not going to have, a silver bullet or anything like that. I think the march is a great first step. I mean, the idea of just sort of advocating for a sort of reason and empiricism and an appreciation for the sort of stepwise nature of science is a great first step, I think. If we get more people talking about how science works and how there is uncertainty in science and how we shouldn't be scared of that, how, you know, progress in science can take many, many years, and sometimes the things we're doing don't sound like we're making progress, but really we are. If we can start talking about those things more and just getting a general appreciation for them in the public, I think it will become harder and harder for people in the political sphere to sort of, you know, to take liberties with science. It becomes harder to do so if everyone is calling you out for it. So I think getting this into the conversation is a great first step.
So, Dave, to borrow the title of your book, I'm not a scientist. I imagine the bulk of people listening are not directly scientists themselves. So how can we, as members of the public, assess science-related statements by politicians? What should we be watching for?
Well, so I think the sort of fundamental message is just to have a bit of skepticism when you listen to political speech about science. A lot of people in politics will talk about things and will take some liberties. So if you just sort of approach it from a sort of basic standpoint of, well, I need to see the evidence for this. I need to understand why you're saying the thing you're saying. That's a good first step. Then there are some specific things to look out for. Words like settled or unsettled tend to be used in inappropriate ways. Or if you hear very specific numbers on certain topics, people used to say there's been no global warming for 17 years. That's a very specific number, and you should be wary of those things because that's not exactly how this sort of thing works. You need to look at trends, not specific numbers. So there are little things like that that you can keep in mind that might help at least, you know, start to pick through some of it. You can always, you know, sort of go to some good sources. If you hear something that sounds questionable, there is still sort of a hierarchy of sources. Look for reputable media outlets that can have written about that topic. So those are some good sort of starting points, I guess.
We'll leave it there. Dave, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was journalist Dave Levitan. His new book is Not a Scientist: How Politicians Mistake, Misrepresent, and Utterly Mangle Science.
Companies hoping to attract top talent frequently offer perks to candidates. Sometimes it can be generous benefits, on-site childcare, or free lunches. But one perk that was seen as trailblazing was offering employees the ability to work from home.
But working remotely may soon become a thing of the past as companies like IBM are telling employees to start coming back to the office. While companies see this as a way to make teams more collaborative and productive, some employees who've gotten used to working from a distance see it as a deal breaker.
Sarah Kessler joins us now to talk about the future of working remotely and how it could affect a number of industries. She's a reporter at Quartz Magazine and covers the changing landscape of work. Sarah, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, Sarah, why are some companies like IBM starting to move away from this idea of working remotely?
So in IBM's case, it was really that they wanted to, in some departments, work more collaboratively and in person. In general, the research is actually kind of mixed about what the best call is in allowing people to work remotely. Some studies have shown that individuals are more productive, but more recently there's been research that says, sure, maybe individuals are productive, but the teams are more productive if they're working together and can easily exchange information. And so that's the better call.
And how do employees feel about having that option on the table, the ability to work from home or maybe not even be in the same city as the company itself?
Well, for a long time, that has been a recruiting tool for some companies, that they can, you know, access talent where they don't have offices and where people don't want to move. In this case, IBM, because it had for so long championed remote work and had been hiring people who worked outside of major offices for so long, in a lot of cases, they were asking employees to move across the country in order to come into the office. And obviously, people who had been working from wherever they were for a long time weren't always happy about that.
And are they one of the leaders doing this? Who else is telling employees, guess what, it's time to come back to the office?
I mean, there aren't so many that are mandating it this abruptly, but there are a lot of companies who encourage people to work near the office in other ways. So, for instance, Facebook offers a $10,000 bonus to employees who live close to the office, or a lot of tech companies offer free lunches and dry cleaning, and all of that is aimed at getting people to be there physically for a longer time.
Now, as I understand it, part of this is, and you were getting at this with some of the research you mentioned, that there may be some synergy that happens, or at least that's the idea, that employees who are working close together, they can bounce ideas off each other, and that they can create more innovative opportunities when they're all together, whereas remotely, we know that employees are more productive. So is this a matter of which is more important, productivity or innovation?
Yeah, I'd say a little bit it is. I think it's reasonable to expect that for different companies and different types of work, the optimal solution will be better or will be different. The research, it's not necessarily, there isn't anything that says this is totally the right way or this is totally the wrong way. But there has been a sense for a long time, intuitively, that people come up with better ideas when they're together. And some of the most successful companies have certainly encouraged that, which has encouraged people to mimic them.
And you write in your article about desk setups where the desks are all pushed together kind of into little pods. Sometimes sounds like it might have been when you were in grade school when you had a little pod that you had to sit with. Does this mean that there's less focus on the individual innovator and more on pushing this idea of teamwork?
Yeah, that's definitely something that a lot of companies moving towards that would say. And that also intuitively makes sense on some level, that you can easily interact with people all day long and overhear things that you might contribute to that you would have never heard about before. Also, at the same time, though, what is happening is that it's becoming more expensive to rent space in cities, and that layout saves a lot of money.
Sarah Kessler is with us right now. She's a reporter at Quartz Magazine, where she looks at the future of jobs. And right now we're talking about why some companies like IBM are phasing out remote work and bringing their employees back into the office. And Sarah, flexibility has been something that has been really prized by employees, the ability to create their own schedule. What does this move by IBM in particular say about the notion of flexibility for employees?
I mean, I think it is probably just putting some limits on it. Really, this move was aimed more at just having people regularly come into the office. You know, they specifically said that they weren't trying to limit flexibility in terms of you have to leave an hour early to attend your child's, you know, Christmas concert or whatever. It was more of they had teams that every member was working from a different state and had never met, and they wanted to remedy that situation. But what I would say is that for a while there was this notion of remote work as something that was the future and that office space would eventually become obsolete. And I don't think that that's true. I think that a lot of companies are realizing that there are a lot of advantages to working together.
Now, some critics have wondered whether this is an indicator that the company doesn't trust its employees. Is there something to that?
I don't know that it's a matter of trust. I think it can just be very burdensome to be coordinating every meeting and every phone call and every interaction with a calendar appointment and an email, and people are looking for more casual encounters. They're also, you know, when Yahoo did this some years ago, they had evidence that there were employees that were not working when they were at home. So that might come into play a little bit.
And technology, it's moving very quickly now, and I know that plays a part in this move to bring employees back to the office. But do you think this could also work in reverse? Could this be a phase about bringing the employees back, and in another 3 or 4 years they discover that the innovations happen anyway? Maybe something else takes precedent and we're back to the more remote work again.
Yeah, that might happen. There are certainly people who would argue that. And I think for some types of work, it does work better than others. You know, there are a lot of freelancers that work alone, but they're working on projects that they largely handle themselves and don't require a lot of teamwork, that they complete to fruition and then hand off to somebody else, which seems better for remote work.
Are there any particular groups of people who this might hit particularly hard, families or parents, for instance?
Well, again, in this particular case, they weren't trying to necessarily become, like, extremely strict about when you needed to be in the office, just that you had to show up for work. But obviously, people who needed to be home for some reason or who liked, you know, taking off for their lunch break to go play with their kids and incorporate it more into their life or work on their own schedule, that's going to be a lot harder.
What do we know about what happens in terms of productivity when workers come back to the office?
So I think, you know, there's limited things on this, but when they've looked at individual productivity, which they did a research in, or they did a study in call centers, and people were actually able to complete more calls on their own without being surrounded by people. But then when you think about group productivity, if we're both on a team and I figure out something that makes me work faster, and now I share that with you, the group productivity has gone up a lot, whereas if we were both working in silos, maybe we would have each been kind of chugging along at a slower pace or at a quicker pace, but together you know, we don't share those ideas that help us work quicker and produce more.
Now, you write about the future of jobs. Are there other ideas that lean toward innovation in terms of the way we work that you see on the horizon that we should be keeping an eye out for?
I mean, the big things that I'm thinking about right now are the trend towards freelance work and how you can coordinate freelancers in new ways that allow you to assign different types of work to them. And then also automation and things that technology will accomplish that we spend time working on as humans today.
So what kinds of things in specific are you thinking of?
On the automation part?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, gosh. There's everything from computer programs that do the work of paralegals to obviously in factories, there's more and more of that work is being automated. I was just in a factory recently where the entire manual inspection process that used to take a person hours going over each part is now done by a computer that looks at photos of each part and compares them to what it should be and can alert people when there's something wrong. And there's probably thousands and thousands of examples. Newspaper reporters, there's a program that will write simple news stories about financial reports or baseball games that are already appearing in newspapers. So it's pretty broad.
A lot of changes coming down the pike. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Sarah Kessler is a reporter at Quartz Magazine, where she looks at the future of jobs, and she joined us today to talk about why some companies like IBM are phasing out remote work and bringing their employees back into the office.
Coming up, Bill O'Reilly is out at Fox News, but our guest wonders, after years of sexual harassment allegations and settlements, what took so long? I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Tonight at 7:30, Tom Ashbrook is at Milwaukee's Latino Arts Center for a live show on race in the age of President Trump. Tune in for a live stream on Wisconsin Public Radio's Facebook page.
Now, Fox News announced yesterday that its primetime host, Bill O'Reilly, will not be returning to the network. The news came after sexual harassment allegations against him became public and an internal investigation later found more cases.
O'Reilly's removal has also come as an embarrassment to his employer and its parent company, 20th Century Fox. A report from the New York Times in April found that the company stood by him and even paid settlements to five women that had complained about sexual harassment from O'Reilly.
The 67-year-old host has been controversial for a long time, though, and not just for his political views, but within the halls of Fox News. The Times reported allegations of inappropriate behavior and verbal abuse dating back to 15 years ago. One of the most well-known cases is from 2004 when a producer filed a sexual harassment lawsuit against O'Reilly, later resulting in a $9 million settlement.
Our next guest says that given O'Reilly's history, he shouldn't have kept his job as long as he did. Amanda Turkle joins us now. She's a senior political reporter and politics managing editor at the Huffington Post. Amanda, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, Amanda, you say that Bill O'Reilly, in your estimation, should have been dismissed long ago. Why do you say that?
Absolutely, he should have been, and it's in part because of what you were just talking about. These sorts of allegations against O'Reilly aren't new. In 2002, he reportedly stormed into a newsroom and screamed at a young producer. The sort of most salacious one that was public was in 2004 when a producer for his show filed a lawsuit against him, claiming sexual harassment, saying that he made inappropriate sexual comments to her on the phone. And so, you know, this has been percolating for a while, in addition to the fact that he often made comments on air that were, you know, not exactly enlightened toward women, you know, about women, about people of color. And internally, you know, Bill O'Reilly was not known at Fox as sort of the nicest guy to work for, the nicest guy toward female employees. So, you know, Fox News kept him around, though, because he was great for ratings and he was good for business, basically.
So given this 15-year history that you just described, why do you think that the tipping point came now?
Well, I think it came in part because of this big New York Times investigation. We knew about a couple of the settlements, but we didn't know that there were at least five that either Bill O'Reilly or the network paid these women to not go forward with their lawsuits and to not go public with their allegations. And they paid, I think, something like $13 million. In addition to them, you've had Wendy Walsh, who was a contributor to the O'Reilly Factor, who didn't sue him at all. So she has been able to be out there publicly on TV, you know, in the media, talking about what O'Reilly did to her. And then this week, right before Fox News decided to fire O'Reilly, you had another anonymous woman talk about how he made sexual and racially inappropriate remarks to her. So it was just sort of snowballing. And the public pressure and internal pressure just became too much for them.
And what do you make about how Bill O'Reilly himself has responded?
Well, O'Reilly has claimed that he did not do any of this, and the reason he is being attacked is simply because he is out there as a public figure, as a man in the arena, and this is just what happens to powerful men, is that they're accused of things like sexual harassment, which is not true. There are plenty of other men on air, including on Fox News, people like Sean Hannity, who haven't had accusations like this pile up against them. It's absolutely not true, and O'Reilly, though, continues to deny them.
So you have Fox News, who has known about some of these cases, these allegations, for a long time, and O'Reilly not dismissed until now with mounting pressure. What does that tell you about maybe the culture at Fox News and the perspective that they were taking over the years?
I mean, O'Reilly was he was sort of the public face of Fox News. He was not only their top guy, he was sort of the top-rated guy on cable news. For a lot of his viewers, this won't necessarily bother them. They continue to like O'Reilly and will actually probably continue to watch the network or maybe also follow O'Reilly wherever he goes if he decides to sort of start his own company. We don't really know. But the problem is that internally, lately, it's just become untenable, I think, for Fox News to keep him. There were obviously the sexual harassment lawsuits and allegations against Roger Ailes, and he left. And the Murdochs promised to sort of create a different sort of network, one that was friendlier toward women, and they promised we're going to clean this place up. And so Roger Ailes was gone, but now there are these accusations piling up against Bill O'Reilly. And internally, a lot of women were saying, look, you're being hypocritical. How can you promise that this place is being cleaned up and you're keeping Bill O'Reilly? So that pressure was there, too.
So do you think that getting rid of these two individuals, Roger Ailes and Bill O'Reilly, does it do enough on the face of things or maybe internally as well to change what many perceive as a hostile culture toward women?
We'll see. They were the ones who internally, I think it goes a long way. But on air, the people you're going to be seeing taking Bill O'Reilly's place honestly really aren't that different. Tucker Carlson, who is going to be filling Bill O'Reilly's old time slot, has made many, many controversial comments about women over the years. Bill O'Reilly's protege, Jesse Waters, who was perhaps best known for doing a segment last year where he went into New York City's Chinatown and just interviewed residents there who didn't speak English very well, mocked them, put all sorts of racist Asian stereotypes into the segment. It was widely condemned by Asian American groups, by journalists. He has been promoted as well and is getting a spot on a primetime show on Fox News. So a lot of these people are going to be in the vein of O'Reilly, sort of following in his legacy just because O'Reilly's gone. You're not maybe necessarily going to see a lot of difference on the outside.
We're talking with Amanda Turkle right now, senior political reporter and politics managing editor at the Huffington Post, looking at Fox News' recent announcement that Bill O'Reilly would not be returning to the network after multiple sexual harassment allegations and settlements. And Amanda, you said you're not going to see a big change, but are you saying then that Bill O'Reilly, even though he was a huge ratings getter for the network, that the Fox News network is, in essence, bigger than O'Reilly, and it's more the Fox brand and less about O'Reilly?
Well, we'll see how much the brand can survive this. I mean, in many ways, they've had a tough year. They've lost Roger Ailes. Now they've lost Bill O'Reilly. They also lost Megyn Kelly and Greta Van Susteren, who went to NBC. you know, they're sort of struggling with what to do now. And this sort of PR around all the sexual assault allegations and what type of place it is for women to work there certainly aren't good. So they are trying to figure out, you know, do they want to be the old type of Fox News that they've been for years, which is, you know, the Bill O'Reilly, Sean Hannity, or, you know, do they want to try to sort of attract a younger generation and branch out a little bit? I mean, I don't think we're going to see Fox News suddenly become liberal or anything like that. But, you know, they're still figuring it out.
Now, you wrote that Bill O'Reilly has been known to offend not just women, but also people of color. He made racist comments about African-American Congresswoman Maxine Waters when he called her hair, quote, James Brown wig. How do you think Fox has handled complaints of racism from O'Reilly?
I mean, I don't think they've done very much over the years. I mean, O'Reilly has liked to say that he's colorblind, even while he's made all these racial remarks. I remember a segment he did where he went, he talked about how he went to Sylvia's, which is a famous soul food restaurant in Harlem, and he marveled that it was just like any other restaurant in New York City, even though it was owned by black people and most of the patrons there were black. To Bill O'Reilly, this was just amazing. He's commented on the education, you know, level and abilities of people of color. I mean, he has said many, many offensive things about people of color over the years, and the network, you know, hasn't seemed to care. And this is carried through again to his protege, Jesse Walters, who did that segment in Chinatown. And some of the allegations being presented to him aren't just sort of sexual harassment allegations, but have that racial tinge. He apparently called a woman who worked at Fox News hot chocolate. So yes, there is that element to him as well.
What is your take about how his treatment of people of color, known by the network for years, as you said, did not lead to his dismissal, but his treatment of white women did seem to lead to that dismissal?
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. And, you know, even beyond that, you know, the way he's talked about LGBT people over the years, too. I think, you know, what this showed in a lot of ways is that there's power in numbers. And so the people who have come forward and either tried to sue him or started to speak out publicly and sort of become a public face, you know, as far as we know, have been white women. And so that is sort of what has happened. But I do think that this most recent allegation with the woman that he referred to as hot chocolate, you know, did have an effect. Since then, another woman, Jamu Green, who is a contributor to Fox News, who's African-American, said that O'Reilly also made sort of leering comments about her. So, yes, it's a bigger problem.
And the Times has reported today that his payout could be as high as $25 million. And now that he is on the way out, how do you think the network is handling it? Have they said enough? Have they been present enough?
Well, yes, the $25 million, I think, shocked. I mean, I don't know how much it shocked people. It's certainly a high amount, but I think people figured that he would be getting some sort of payout since they did just sign him to another contract for 3 years and were going to keep him until all this happened. But the network has quite a bit of damage control to do. Obviously, the network has not been covering his ouster as much as, you know, you've seen it all sort of all day on CNN and MSNBC. But the network sort of put out their comment, and they're sort of leaving it at that.
We're talking with Amanda Turkle right now, senior political reporter and politics managing editor at the Huffington Post, looking at the announcement from Fox News that Bill O'Reilly won't be returning to the network after multiple sexual harassment allegations and settlements.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of how Fox handled the sexual harassment allegations, the settlements that have happened over the years related to Bill O'Reilly? Do you think he should have been dismissed yesterday? Do you think he should have been dismissed sooner or should still be on the air? Have you watched the show? Were you a regular fan of the show? What do you think about all this? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up our conversation with Amanda Turkle, senior political reporter at the Huffington Post, and we're talking about the news that Fox News will not be having Bill O'Reilly back. He won't be returning to his job after multiple sexual harassment allegations.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us what you think about the end of the Bill O'Reilly era at Fox News. Was Fox right to let him go? Were they wrong to keep him around as long as they did? Do you think he should still be on the air? And what do you think about how sexual harassment is handled more generally? Big companies like Fox News and elsewhere. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take our first caller now. We have Jim on the line in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
Well, I must say, you know, I appreciate your guest's comments. In all the offensive things that O'Reilly has said over the decades, it's about to be left. But I can't see Fox changing their formula, because they've made tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars on a anti-feminist, anti-liberal, anti-diversity theorem or formula of politics, which appeals to a very hardcore right-wing base, I mean, that wants to hear that stuff. And I'd be interested in your guest's response. Thank you.
Jim, thank you for that call and that comment. And Amanda, I want to ask you, there is some suggestion in the analysis that the people who watch Bill O'Reilly, who enjoyed the way he approached the news, that it might not have been a big impact on them, these sexual harassment allegations. So given that, what do you think happens next?
Yeah, I mean, Fox News wants to make money. So if they believe that they can still make money by presenting this sort of, you know, content and information and opinion to their base, then they will. But, you know, I don't know how much longer Fox News's base will be there. You know, Rachel Maddow, for example, she on MSNBC, her viewership has been going up, and she's been doing very well. Obviously, presents a very different viewpoint from Fox News, and you know, in many ways, the conservative base itself isn't quite as sort of consistent and as it used to be. You know, you have Republicans who like Trump, Republicans who don't like Trump, who more economic populists, more foreign policy hawks, and so Fox News has to figure out sort of which segment they want to appeal to. And so I think, you know, those business decisions are going to be what driving them. And yeah, if they continue these sort of anti-feminist sort of views, if those are popular, I think they'll probably keep them.
Jim, thanks a lot for that call. And we're going to go next to Nancy, joining us from Wausau. Nancy, hi.
Hi there. My comment on it is I'm very glad to see Bill O'Reilly gone. I recently took the stand here in Wausau that I wanted to see Ted Nugent removed from our fair lineup because of his hateful, racist comments. I could really care less what anybody's political affiliation is, but we should not accept this. There is no room for those kind of hateful, racist comments.
Nancy, thank you for that. And do you think, Amanda, do you sense that maybe the media and the culture at large is entering a new era where there might be less tolerance for this kind of behavior?
Well, I think actually part of the reason that Bill O'Reilly did lose his job was sort of strangely the rise of Donald Trump. Obviously, during the election, he made some comments that sort of implied that he condoned sexual assault and used his position of power to do so. And, you know, he did end up getting elected, but he also sort of started this national conversation and got a lot of women very upset about these sorts of issues. And then you saw after the election, the Women's March, which brought thousands of people to Washington, D.C., and then out around the country as well. And so I think there is, in many ways, even though Donald Trump was elected, less tolerance for these sorts of things, more awareness, and more people speaking out. And so I think in some ways, you know, that is the type of culture that got Bill O'Reilly kicked out.
Well, and you were mentioning how it's not enough for supporters to be there. Even people who did not necessarily watch Fox News could have had a say on social media and had sway with advertisers.
Right, exactly. The advertisers thing was also a big reason that O'Reilly lost his job. There was the internal pressure, there was this publicly people getting fed up, but the fact that, you know, something like half of O'Reilly's advertisers went away from his show, you know, that was pretty bad for Fox News, too. And, they're, you know, again, they're a business and that they want to make money.
Nancy, thanks a lot. And let's go next to Harry. Harry's joining us in La Crosse. Hi, Harry.
Well, hi. Yeah, I was just curious. Sorry, but I hope you can hear me.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of traffic. I'm not driving, though. If what he did was bad enough to get let go, why is he leaving the network with so much money? It's not really a punishment when he can leave with $25 million or plus.
Yeah, interesting question, Harry. Is there a contractual sort of clause there for him? What's happening with that, Amanda?
Well, I don't know the details on that, but I do. I mean, his contract actually did say that he can receive a maximum of 1 year's salary when he left, and the most recent contract was reportedly worth about $25 million. So, you know, he can receive up to that amount. Like I said, they recently signed him again for a 3-year contract, and so this was part of, you know, they decided that this money was worth it to get rid of him.
Harry, thank you for the question. And another call here from John calling us from Grand Rapids. John, hello.
Hey, hello. Thank you for having me on. You know, I remember years ago when he did that Hollywood news show and he didn't know he was on the air and he was screaming and verbally abusive. I believe it was a female coworker. I don't recall. He was a jerk. That's all he ever was. And I just don't know why the right, who claims to have the moral high ground, tolerates people like this. And then when you have Bill Clinton, he gets impeached for sex offenses. This guy gets their admiration, and I don't understand the double standard. And I think the only reason he got fired is because the advertisers were pulling their money out. I don't think there's any moral decision that was made about his behavior. It was all about the money.
John, thank you for that thought there, for sharing that with us. And Amanda, I mean, how would you explain? And he was obviously very successful at what he did, Bill O'Reilly. He brought in millions of viewers. How would you explain the appeal?
He was very good at creating sort of this black and white world. There were culture warriors. He was very good at sort of finding some little thing that was going on around the country. Maybe a school decided that the war on Christmas, for example, was very big for Bill O'Reilly. He would get very outraged when a school would decide that it was going to say Happy Holidays and maybe not do a Christmas show and do a holiday show instead. And he created the world in these very sort of stark terms. And I think that appealed to a lot of people. You were either with him and with, you know, the sort of American values, or you were on this other side with the far left extremists and this sort of liberal, horrible liberal world. And so O'Reilly really fashioned this sort of moral persona for himself. He even sort of strangely wrote a book for children about manners. But that wasn't necessarily the Bill O'Reilly that people at Fox News knew. It was sort of a poorly kept secret that people at Fox News didn't really like him. He was known as sort of a jerk. He was known as being a bit of a bit boorish. And so, you know, he didn't have a lot of defenders in the end.
Now, as we wrap up, just about 30 seconds left or so, is there anyone ready to step in who's cut from that same Bill O'Reilly cloth, or are we really seeing a culture shift in terms of the approach Fox takes?
Well, like I said, his protege, Jesse Waters, is going to be on prime time now, and Tucker Carlson, obviously hasn't had the sort of sexual harassment allegations that Bill O'Reilly has, but, you know, still sort of, you know, this conservative guy who's willing to sort of push buttons and say sort of things that you're used to hearing on Fox News. And so right now, in many ways, the lineup does look very familiar.
Amanda, thanks so much for joining us.
Great. Thanks for having me.
That was Amanda Turkle, senior political reporter and politics managing editor at The Huffington Post, talking about the dismissal of Bill O'Reilly from Fox News.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, chronic wasting disease numbers are up in some deer populations in Wisconsin, but our guest says the DNR isn't sounding the alarm about the problem.
And on Food Friday, WPR's Lori Skelton is back with some great fish recipes, including a delicious fish pie.
That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.